Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by Liberty Coin Service, now open with a new location in Frandor, offering gold buying and coin collecting services in one combined location for more than 40 years. LibertyCoinService.com.
Welcome back to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Delighted to have you along here for Tuesday, March 5th, 2013. Coming up later in the hour, we'll try to learn more, a little bit more about our new Supreme Court Justice here in the state of Michigan. Judge David Viviano launches a new term on the state Supreme Court here later today. We'll visit with Cooley Law School professor Ron Bretz to try to find out more about David Viviano. We've also got a new city attorney here in the city of Lansing, Janine McIntyre. And as it turns out, Ron Bretz, who will be in to talk to us about the new state Supreme Court judge, taught Janine McIntyre at Cooley Law School. So we've got the stars kind of align in the second half of the program later today. We'll talk about Michigan's climate future as well with state climatologist Jeff Andreessen. But first, administrators in a variety of public programs continue to weigh and plan as best they can for the impact of federal sequestration. Last Friday, $85 billion of federal budget cutting began taking effect. Across the political spectrum, critics of sequestration say the cuts are highly indiscriminate. And joining me to discuss their views are Gilda Jacobs, who is president and CEO of the Michigan League for Public Policy. Welcome, Gilda.
Thank you.
And Lucy McClintic is the director of Head Start for the four counties nearest Lansing, Ingham, Clinton, Eaton, and Shiawassee. Welcome, Lucy.
Good morning.
Nice to see you. Is it any clearer today than it was last Friday, for example? What impact sequestration will have on low and middle income families in Michigan, Gilda?
Well, we've been concerned all along during this whole debate. We know that there will be major impacts. I know Lucy is going to be talking about the impacts to Head Start, but if you take a look at K-12, special education, employment and adult education, students who depend on federal dollars for student loans to get themselves through child care and development grants. All of those are on the cutting board. And this will have a significant effect on a lot of low-income and middle-income people. Every day we will start seeing some kind of a change as the sequestration cuts start to take
Are you seeing cuts being identified, though? I mean, do you know in detail what programs are being cut and by how much?
Well, we can figure out how much is lost right now. Understand that the state budget, about 41% of our total state budget relies on federal dollars. Mm-hmm. So that is a very important number to take into into the equation. So if you're having these sort of across-the-board cuts, then you're going to see this in all sorts of different programs. DHS, for example, I think something like 82% of their budget are federal dollars. WIC, food kinds of things, you know, those are dollars that are going to be somewhat affected by this as well.
Lucy McClintic, what about cuts to Head Start specifically? What can you tell us about those?
Well, I can tell you about our program, and then I can talk about Michigan in general. But a 5% cut to our program would be a loss of $625,000. And I can tell you we cannot make that up with cuts here and there. It will move into looking at all of our program, losing children, losing services, perhaps losing bus routes. At this point, we're planning on a reduction of about 150 children, and that would be across our four counties. So it's very serious as we begin to plan for next year, what classrooms will have to be changed, what services will be changed.
But do you know you're looking at a 5% cut?
That's what we've been told, yes. Okay. We've had calls from Washington, from the National Head Start office, to look at a 5% cut.
Okay. Let's get a handle on the pre-sequestration size of some of these key budgets. Gilda, what's been the recent trend? I mean, we're led to believe that there's already been quite a bit of cutting that's been going on. Where are you now, pre-sequestration, compared to, say, 5 years ago?
Well, if you just take a look at our state budget, we've made cuts to a lot of programs steadily over the years anyways, just in our state. So if you then take those reductions of programs and then overlay the sequestration cuts, we're talking about a significant difference in the lives of people who kind of depend on some of these dollars coming through. You know, we're really moving really into a crisis as this really unfolds.
What about Head Start, Lucy?
Well, I think the same thing is true for us. We've seen a number of years of flat funding, but I guess what I'd like to talk about is sort of the double, triple, quadruple whammy that some of our families will be facing. I mean, many of them are parents that are juggling two and three jobs that depend on Head Start for a portion of their child care or all of their child care. Many of them take advantage of WIC services. They're going to school. They're trying to get ahead with scholarships and loans. So it's all of these cuts will be affecting our program in a number of ways. We actually have a WIC on site. We actually have adult ed on site at one of our largest centers. And so you're going to just be magnifying all of these cuts as they go through and plan out.
Yes, Gilda, continue. I was going to say,
you know, if we take a look at, for example, the fact that Michigan already cut the unemployment benefits for unemployment insurance benefits,
right,
from 26 to 20 weeks. So you already have people that are struggling to make ends meet. If you put on top of some of these other cuts of programs in terms of housing kinds of programs, homeless assistance programs, Meals on Wheels for people who are shut-ins. You talked about WIC. Some of the career and employment education programs that, if you want to be able to get people retrained to go out, we're going to have effects with that.
You would both maintain there is no room for cutting?
Oh, absolutely.
Really, no.
How can you absorb $625,000?
The fat disappeared a long time ago.
The fat disappeared a long time ago, yes.
Okay. Sequestration came less than 2 months after Governor Snyder proposed a $130 million increase for Michigan's Great Start Readiness Program for low and moderate income kids for a couple of years, I guess. I imagine passage of that part of the governor's budget has become more important after the sequester. Lucy?
That's true. However, the funding level for Great Start Readiness is substantially lower than Head Start because of all the comprehensive services that we provide. But yes, we try to blend with over 100 children Head Start and Great Start Readiness to provide full day. Again, looking at what do the neediest of the needy children, and Great Start Readiness is designed to serve the children above 100% of poverty. Head Start serves the children below 100% of poverty.
Okay. Just to contrast the projections here, though, the Obama administration says sequestration threatens to eliminate 2,300 Head Start slots in Michigan. You project 100 or so here in the
150
four,
in our area,
150
yes.
in our four counties. The governor's number crunchers project an increase in preschool placements. Again, this is the Great Start Readiness Program, from 32,000 next year to 48,000 in 2014. But you're saying these are different populations.
They're different
that are being
populations
served.
And they're different services. Certainly it would help, and we will do everything in our power to cut as few children as possible or to refer children to the Great Start Readiness or to blend Great Start and Head Start together, I think the ultimate loss will still be a loss to our area as well as the state of Michigan. Our children rely on us to help with medical and dental care, with nutritious meals, with counseling services. You know, it's a much more comprehensive program funded at a higher level than the Great Start Readiness Program, but it would help.
And also, Lucy, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that in the president's budget, he wants to put in more money into early childhood, I think into four-year-olds at this point, I'm not positive, kind of aligns with what Governor Snyder wants to do. So there may be an opportunity, actually, that maybe more kids can get young kids can get some kind of services in the state. And that's kind of obviously up in the air as that goes through the budget process at the federal level.
Absolutely. And, you know, President Obama's funding projections or hopes are also to look at increasing the number of services for 0 to 3. Currently, in our program, we only serve 160 infants and toddlers, and we serve 1,457 preschoolers. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge difference between 0 to 3 services, and that is true throughout the whole state. I mean, you're looking at a difference of almost 33,000 Head Start children and then only 5,400 early Head Start children.
There's the oddest dichotomy here involving what appears to be the growing acceptance of the importance of early childhood education.
Absolutely.
This is being adopted across the board. But if the funding isn't there, how much progress could possibly be made with these early childhood innovations?
It's two steps forward and maybe three back, and then another one forward. And you know, this is kind of what we're dealing with, trying to figure out how will we best serve, and what I believe, the neediest of the needy first, and then move on to universal preschool. I think research shows that preschool programs, high-quality preschool programs, make a difference in a child's education and outcomes for the rest of their life.
Right.
Again, looking at, I believe, serving the neediest of the needy first and then moving on to universal preschool.
Gilbert, continue.
I was just going to say, if you take a look at some of the other projected budgetary effects, you also have special education. We are looking at over $20 million of a loss, and that translates into 240 teachers and aides and about just under 10,000 students that would be affected, because a lot of those dollars come from the feds to support those kinds of programs. And even elementary and secondary education act, we're looking at a $22 million cut as well. So we're talking 300 teachers, 25,000 students, 80 schools. So it's the early childhood, but it goes really in through K-12 as well.
Gilda Jacobs, we've got under a minute. What areas aside from education really rise to the top of concern for you?
Well, I'm very concerned about the health and nutrition cuts and the housing cuts, because those are areas that have really been affected by the recession and unemployment in Michigan. And while we're struggling to do better, there are still people every day who cannot make their basic needs.
Are we looking at just a greater number of Michigan citizens who will fall through some kind of crack, homelessness, mental health,
absolutely,
hunger?
Absolutely. And we can't afford to let that happen.
Okay. All right. On that note, we will wrap up. But we really appreciate the time. Our guests have been Gilda Jacobs, President and CEO of the Michigan League for Public Policy, and Lucy McClintock, Director of Head Start for the four counties nearest Lansing. Thanks very much. Its current state on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. Climate change is continuing to influence Michigan's natural sector. Last March, a dramatic thaw and then refreeze devastated the state's fruit crops, while recently record low water levels have forced the government to spend millions on dredging. Here to discuss how climate change might continue to impact the state in the future is Jeff Andreessen, who's Michigan climatologist and an assistant professor of geography here at Michigan State University. Nice to see you, Jeff.
Good to see you, too.
Could we talk at first about how much Michigan's climate has already varied over the years? How much variation can you say is built in to climate change
right.
is already a part of the is it just part of the ongoing
there's
process?
A great deal. Well, geologically, we've been everything from tropical climate 400 million years ago to glacial.
Those were the days.
So geologically, we're looking at a huge range, but in human lifetime, we have about 150 years of reliable records. And in that period, we know that we've warmed overall about 1 degree Fahrenheit over the last century or so. And Michigan and the Great Lakes region have become wetter. We have now about 4 or 5 inches more of precipitation per year than we did back 50, 60 years ago. So warmer and wetter is the direction we've been. And that's especially been true over the last 2 to 3 decades.
Okay, so looking forward, the EPA predicts that by the end of the century, the climate here in the Midwest may resemble something closer to Arkansas's. Is that a valid or an accurate way to envision Michigan's climate future?
I think conceptually it does help. We're looking at the projections of the future, and it depends on what assumptions are made, talking about maybe a 4 to as much as 11 degree Fahrenheit increase in temperatures by the end of the century.
And we went up 1 degree right. in 150 years and 4 to 11 by the end of this century.
Right. And to some, actually, that doesn't sound like that much. But when you look at it over a large area over a short period of time, that's a very, very significant change. So, yes, at least conceptually, one would have to go fairly far away to see a climate that much warmer than what we've had recently.
Let's talk about some of the potential effects of climate change and some that we may already be witnessing. The Great Lakes are part of the Midwest economy. How will warmer temperatures affect the Great Lakes?
There are a number of potential impacts. Agriculture is the one that I'm most familiar with. It's my specialty area. And we can say that probably that there will be some winners, some losers. Some parts of our region, including Michigan, actually may benefit from a warmer and wetter. They already have probably benefited from a warmer, wetter climate and could in the near-term future, while other areas, especially as one goes out into the Great Plains or towards the west and south, probably will become drier. That's what the projections are. So at least for agriculture, we're looking at a mixed bag. There are a number of other weather-dependent industries. One that we think about this time of year, but is the winter outdoor recreation industry and the fact that we likely will see less snow cover on the ground, less snowfall in future decades. That's a concern certainly for snowmobiling, skiing, other winter recreational activities.
How has it already changed? You alluded to the fact that we've already seen a few changes or minor changes.
The big changes we've seen, temperature, it turns out we've seen warmer winters. Milder winters is one of the most significant in terms of our temperatures. We've actually have warmed 2 degrees Fahrenheit just in the last 30 years. Much of that has been during the winter and at night.
But are we seeing changes in the crop, the crops, or that kind of thing?
Research suggests that we actually have had in Michigan and parts of the Great Lakes region, we've actually done better. We've had higher yields. Part of that is because of more favorable climate, at least in the last couple of decades.
Okay. Last March, we had a dramatic episode in terms of temperatures. We had temperatures in the 80s, not quite a year ago, if memory serves. And then we had a frost all over again, which just devastated the fruit crops here in Michigan. Is this related to climate change?
An excellent question. Yeah.
And is this a pattern that we're likely to continue to see?
A couple of comments, and we're just about 1 year anniversary when the heat wave of 2012 began. We've run out of superlatives to describe what happened in a 2.5-week period last March. We set thousands of new records, warmest March on record by far for Michigan and 25 of states of the 50 states. But this likely, if one would have asked 20 years ago, we would have said this was an extreme weather event. But now there are a couple of other issues here. One is that the physical mechanisms that were responsible for the heat wave last year are consistent both with weather and then the longer term climate as well. But more importantly, this is following a trend. Our springs are coming earlier with time. That's one of the other very significant trends. The spring warm-up is occurring earlier and earlier with time. And the projections of the future suggest, from what we have or what we know, that this may occur or may continue to occur in the future. So I think that while it was a weather event, an extreme weather event, like the drought of 2012 was an extreme weather event, they're not mutually exclusive. They're not completely independent, and that may be some small part of what happened in March of 2012 and during the summer of 2012 are linked with a longer-term change. So, again, at some point we would have said those are weather and this is climate, and they're not related. But now I think that there is we can't say that any longer.
So. Are we learning more as to what's behind the climate change?
Yes. Almost all of the evidence points in the direction of human activity and changes in greenhouse gas composition in the atmosphere. That gets stronger and stronger each year. And so, yes, there is natural variability of our climate system. However, again, the vast majority of evidence continues to point towards a finger towards human activity as being the primary issue here.
We're talking with state climatologist Jeff Andreessen. What about Michigan's wildlife? Can we project how much the wildlife makeup might change?
Well, it's a complicated question. There almost certainly would be changes, and that's true for both the land-based species and also aquatic species in our lakes and rivers as well. But we also have to look at the ecosystems, the composition of vegetation, and if the projections do hold out here as time goes on, there will be significant shifts and or changes of both plant species and animal species across the state.
How might the people of Michigan begin to transition or prepare for this warmer, wetter Michigan?
This is I think we're already seeing some evidence of this. We're spending less money for heating, for one. That's a positive thing, but we're spending more money to cool our environments during the summer because we have warmer temperatures in the summer than we have in the past. That's one simple one. It just depends on the type of weather-dependent activities we deal with or where we are. But heating and cooling is one very, very real one that's already actually occurring.
We've seen more and more unexpected disasters here, and Sandy comes to mind, the superstorm. Are these extreme events part of climate change, or is this more a part of the new norm?
Once again, I think those are weather events. Sandy was, but there is some consistency with the theory, and ultimately, again, I think climate change may be playing at least some small role in this in a longer-term trend. So we can't, exclude her mutual... They're not completely mutually exclusive.
Gotcha. Jeff Andreessen is the state of Michigan climatologist. He is also an assistant professor of geography here at Michigan State University. This environmental segment of Current State is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. For more news about the Great Lakes environment, you can find more at greatlakesecho.org. Jeff Andreessen, always good to see you.
My pleasure. Thanks.
On the second half of Current State, Scott Pohl reports on the city of Lansing's new city attorney, Janine McIntyre. We'll also learn more about David Viviano. He's our new Michigan Supreme Court Justice, beginning his first session. Today, we'll check in with Ron Bretz of Cooley Law School. You're listening to Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State on WKAR. You can reach us via email at currentstate@wkar.org. We're always interested in your opinions and your story segment ideas. We've just learned here in the past few seconds, courtesy of the Associated Press, that the Dow Jones Industrial Average has officially traded above the all-time closing high dating all the way back to October of 2007. It seems like a long, long time ago, given the road that we have traveled since then. But that puts the Dow, I guess, at 14,100, 200, or thereabouts. So it's already traded above its all-time high here just after the market opened just a couple of minutes ago. The Michigan Farmers Market Conference takes place today and tomorrow in East Lansing as part of Agricultural and Natural Resources Week. The growth and expansion of farmers markets is one of the most visible aspects of Michigan's vibrant local and regional food renaissance. Drew Montry is the owner of Ten Hens Farm, just north of us here in Bath, Michigan, and director of the Michigan Farmers Market Association. WKAR's Peter Worf spoke with Drew about organizing Michigan's markets and this week's conference.
To be able to start a farmers market takes time and energy, people power, and planning. So we talk with markets about, first of all, feasibility, really thinking through if a market is right in their community, and not only if a market is right, but if they also have the kind of energy and resources that are necessary to start a market. We talk about basic kind of principles of starting a farmer's markets, licensing and regulation, kind of state rules, developing strong market policies, and then promotion, outreach, recruiting and retaining vendors, and a whole slew of things that go into kind of starting markets.
Seems it would be a difficult proposition to get a farmer's market off the ground in that you're looking for a right number of people and a right variety of things. And that would be hard to do, I'd think.
Yeah, it's not a simple task. Yeah. So I think one of probably the biggest misconceptions is about farmers markets is that people will look at a farmers market and they'll be like, oh, it just pops up, operates for 4 hours, pops down. That's got to be a piece of cake. And the reality is that it's not. It actually takes a lot of energy behind getting that market to operate the way that it does. And so it takes a lot of planning and making sure, kind of organization, to make sure those markets function. And, you know, at this time of year in our conference, we're not helping people, you know, necessarily start a farmer's market in May, which is 2 months away. We're helping them. Some markets are to the point where they definitely can, and they're just looking for, you know, kind of pointers on tips to get the season off to a right start. Some markets are at very early stages of just thinking about a farmer's market, and they'll have a whole season, kind of a year of planning, and we'd encourage them to start next year because it does take a while to get all the kind of bricks in place to have your market functioning well and start off, you know, as a really successful market.
So that's a little bit about boot camp. We've touched just very briefly on that. What about the next track?
Yeah, so we also have an advanced market manager track, and this came out of our boot camp where we were having market managers ask for more in-depth sessions and more specific topics that would not focus necessarily on all of the basics, but really kind of get into some of the things that they deal with regularly. Those type of topics, a lot of market managers are managing volunteers, and so we're having a session this year on volunteer management. We have sessions on kind of children's activities, special events, and special promotions that you can do at your market. And so this track is really focused on more specific programming and extra things that you can add to your market to enhance your market above and beyond kind of the essentials of starting a market.
Right.
The third track is specifically for farmers and vendors. So our association's target audience is definitely the individuals and organizations that manage farmers markets, but we also work with and for the farmers and the vendors, the small businesses that are selling at farmers markets. And so this track is really geared toward farmers and small businesses, and we focus on things that they need to know to be successful at the farmers market. And so that covers ranges kind of from production topics to more specific farmers market topics like risk management and merchandising and display.
What types of farmers are attracted to developing new markets and which are not?
Well, you know, to sell at a farmer's market, you have to have the personality and kind of the attitude that you want to be interacting directly with people. And farmers markets can be a great fit for a lot of people, but you need to be a people person, because one of the great things about farmers markets is that you get to interact with your customers directly, and your customers get to interact with you. And those interactions really kind of drive your sales. And so while farmers markets are a great opportunity to, you know, take home a larger portion of the food dollar, you're kind of cutting out the middleman, and they're really an opportunity to try new business ideas because they're pretty low risk in terms of, you know, low capital to get into. You also have to have the right type of personality to be in a situation where you're interacting directly with your customers the entire time that you're at the farmer's market.
Your farm is called 10 Hens.
Yeah, we're 10 Hens Farm in Bath, Michigan. My background is in horticulture, and I grew up knowing that that's kind of the route I would go. I've always loved gardening and knew that I wanted to scale up that experience. And my husband and I met at Michigan State. We worked in kind of the local foods arena in Pennsylvania for a few years, traveled after that, and through a program called WOOF, Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms. And so we got to work on other farms in the Southwest on the Pacific coast of the country, and we came back knowing we wanted to start our own farm. So I work for the Farmers Market Association. My husband works for MSU in the horticulture department, and we bought our farm in 2007. And we grow vegetables year round. But the first addition to our farm was that my husband traded a woman he was building a hoop house for her, and she traded us 10 hens.
Right.
And so the first start at our farm were 10 hens.
But one was a rooster.
Exactly. We've never had 10 hens, right. Come to find out. So we had a rooster, and now we're down to 2 hens during the winter, but we have 2 little girls, so we're starting our flock over again in the spring.
Tell me more about what we'd see at your farm. What are you planning to put in?
Well, we grow year-round, so right now it's spring planting. So this week we harvested the last of our pak choy, which was the last of our cold hardy crops, and we are now planting salad mix, Swiss chard, kale, spinach, radishes, turnips, peas, which are my children's favorites, and a lot of spring crops.
All the early stuff, of course.
Yeah, it's that time of year. March is a good time for planting the spring stuff in our hoop house. And then, of course, we plant in the field as well, but that doesn't come until a little later in the year, May.
Is what you're describing kind of a typical sized farm for being involved with local farmers markets?
Well, I think, yeah, when you look at the research on farmers markets, there's a lot of small-scale farmers that are selling to farmers markets, and those are typically between, like, 2 and 10 acres. That being said, there are also a number of larger farms, especially in Michigan, that are selling at farmers markets as well, and they do so on a much larger scale, with farmers markets being one part of their direct marketing. So we also work with farmers that have hundreds of acres that are selling to 20 markets a week, you know, on a much larger scale. So that's not uncommon either.
Drew Montry is the director of the Michigan Farmers Market Association. Drew, good luck with the conference, and thanks for the conversation.
Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
Last week, Governor Rick Snyder named Macomb County Chief Circuit Judge David Viviano to the Michigan Supreme Court. Viviano replaces former Justice Diane Hathaway, who resigned in January under a cloud of scandal related to her involvement in a fraudulent real estate deal. Viviano's worked as a city attorney, he was also a Republican nominee for Macomb County prosecutor. Ron Bretz chaired the Criminal Law and Procedure Department at Cooley Law School in Lansing. He's a longtime Michigan Supreme Court watcher, and he joins us now to talk about the makeup of the Michigan Supreme Court in the Viviano era. Ron Bretz, nice to have you join us here.
Thanks.
This morning. What the court now has a 5-2 Republican majority. What might that mean for future cases?
Well, I think that the first thing to understand is that the court has had a Republican majority for most of the last 20-some years. We had a period a couple of years ago where we had a Democratic majority, almost majority for a few months when we had Justice Davis there, but he's gone now. So the court has had a 4-3 Republican majority for quite a while. This will make it 5-2, so it really won't change the party alignments on the court. I know we say they're non-party.
Non-political,
but
yeah.
But they are all nominated by parties. All seven of our current justices have party affiliations.
What do we know about Dave Viviano?
Well, that's kind of interesting. He's never been an appellate judge. He's been a trial judge for a few years in Macomb County. And ordinarily, the politically smart thing they say for a governor to do is to appoint a court of appeals judge to the Supreme Court. That gives him, the governor, another appointment to the court of appeals. You put a trial judge on the court of appeals, and that gives the governor yet a third appointment to the trial bench. This time, and by the way, last time Governor Snyder had an appointment, he did exactly that. He appointed Justice Zara, Brian Zara,
right,
who was a court of appeals judge, and that gave the governor
a couple more appointments.
This time he didn't do that. He reached down to the trial bench. So in terms of now soon-to-be Justice Viviano, we don't know what his appellate record is because he's never served as an appellate judge. He's been a trial judge. That's a very different kind of job. In that sense, though, the Macomb County attorneys I've spoken to who've appeared in front of him have given him high marks as a fair judge, a judge who will listen to arguments, will let you try your case, and tries to rule on the merits. No telling what he will do when he gets to the Supreme Court.
What do you make of Rick Snyder passing up the opportunity to appoint an appellate judge to the Supreme Court?
Well, I don't know. One could say that this is that Governor Snyder, not being a real lifetime politician, he's not going the usual political route here. One could say that he's trying to find the best person for the job. But let's not forget that Judge, soon-to-be Justice Viviano, is a member of a legal family that is quite powerful in Macomb County. His father was a judge. His sister is currently a judge. He's the chief judge of Macomb Circuit Court. And by the way, the chief judge is appointed by the Michigan Supreme Court. So they've already appointed him the chief judge down there. His family owns some very high-profile businesses in Macomb County. Anyone in Macomb County knows about Viviano's flowers.
Okay.
And longtime members of the Republican Party. David Viviano has been a member and a contributor to the Republican Party. So in that sense, yes, he found someone from his own party to appoint. But in another sense, the governor did not give himself a chance to fill three spots.
Right.
Just one. Well, perhaps two. He'll have to fill the Macomb bench seat.
The GOP justices sometimes view themselves as textualists,
yes,
which means that they interpret the law as it's written rather than bringing in their own subjective interpretations, I guess. And that's what all judges might argue is their role. Do you agree that's the case on the Michigan Supreme Court?
Well, I do agree that the leading philosophy on the Michigan Supreme Court is one of textualism. And from a purely philosophical standpoint, there's some sense to it. In other words, they say, we are not going to pretend the legislature meant X when they wrote Y. Okay? We are only going to decide the plain words of the statute.
Of Y.
What do they mean? And they actually look at dictionaries. Now, someone did a study once, because the U.S. Supreme Court, particularly under Justice Scalia, he's the grand poobah of textualism. He's written two books on it. And he says you have to interpret the Constitution, for example, textually. But some things simply don't yield themselves to textualism. For example, the Constitution says that no person shall be denied due process of law. But they don't tell us what that is. It's up to the court to decide what is fairness. Cruel and unusual punishment. No one tells us what that is, so it is up to the court to decide what is cruel and unusual. And so textualism doesn't resolve all issues. One more thing I'll add there is that I've spent much of my last 10 or 15 years of my career studying Michigan Supreme Court decisions, and I always delight when I find a decision where the textualists on the court, which is primarily the Republican justices, mm-hmm, disagree on what the pure plain text says. There's one case from a couple years ago where there's three separate opinions from three Republican justices, and they're all saying it means something different. So the reality is every justice on a Supreme Court in a state or in the national level has to bring into the job the idea that they have to interpret laws that are not always written in the most artful manner.
What do you make of criticisms that were made 20 years or so ago by Governor Engler and the whole Cliff Taylor era that started this thing of an activist court, though? Can you say that the pendulum swings in the other direction too far?
Yes,
occasionally.
Absolutely. In fact, I would say the court that became known as the Engler Court, as of 1999, he had appointed a majority of the justices on that court under the leadership of then Chief Justice Cliff Taylor. And that court declared itself to be believe in judicial restraint and judicial conservatism and rule of law, and yet they spent 15 years overturning just about every precedent from their own court. I did a study on this a couple of years ago, and I accumulated that they did over, I think, 1,400 years of their own precedent they overturned. And that's not judicial restraint. If you look up judicial activism, one of the first things you'll find is no respect for precedent. And I think most lawyers will tell you that the Michigan Supreme Court, through much of the first part of this century, has had no respect for precedent.
How interesting. Governor Snyder has, on a few occasions, asked the court for preemptive rulings on issues like tax overhauls, the emergency manager law. He's also asked the court for just such a ruling on right to work before it takes effect in about 3 weeks. What might happen with that request? How do you process all that?
Well, I think that the court, no matter what their politics are, is going to be not anxious to take these cases up preemptively. It's very unusual. It's not done very often. And ordinarily, I'm just talking ordinarily, the appellate court, particularly the Supreme Court, would rather see a case work its way through the system, give other judges, give lower court judges a shot at it, see how they rule on it, and then we will take it up. With purely legal questions, okay, in other words, questions that don't require testimony, don't require witnesses, because you can't do that in an appellate court. If there's going to be testimony or witnesses, evidence introduced, that has to be done in a trial court. But if it's purely a legal question, does the law mean this? Does the Constitution permit this or not? That is the kind of question that can be resolved preemptively by the Supreme Court. I understand what Governor Snyder is trying to do. He's trying to save a lot of roller coaster is what what if a lower court says it's unconstitutional, then a court of appeals says it's constitutional. Now we're going two different ways. We don't know what's what. And then we have to wait sometimes years for the Supreme Court to give us the final word. And even then, that might not be the final word. The case might end up in the United States Supreme Court. Right. So Governor Snyder's trying to short circuit all that. And I don't see that as being a bad thing, but I also don't think the court's going to be real anxious to jump on it.
How long? I want to revisit this whole issue of Judge Viviano's lack of appellate experience. Mm-hmm. How long will it take for him to sit on the state Supreme Court before we start to get a read on that?
It's hard to say. We have a thing we call a condition we call new judge-itis, where a judge
very scientific.
Yes, very scientific. this is how lawyers talk to themselves in the back rooms. But what we do is we'll see a judge who's never been an appellate judge be appointed to the Court of Appeals. And typically that judge's first authored opinion, okay, where he signs his name, I'm the one who wrote this, they're usually quite lengthy, quite lucid. They're shooting for a masterpiece their first time out of the box. And I would not be surprised to see the Chief Justice, who's now Justice Young, give new Justice Viviano an assignment to write a weighty opinion in a case that should be coming soon down the line.
Okay.
We don't know what he's going to be doing. We don't know. But I suspect he has already pledged that he is going to be consistent in his judicial philosophy with the current majority.
Very good. Longtime Supreme Court watcher Ron Bretz chaired the Criminal Law and Procedure Department at Cooley Law School in Lansing. This has been fun. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you.
Its current state. If Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero has his way, Janine McIntyre will be Lansing's next city attorney. She would succeed Brigham Smith, who left for a similar job in Connecticut earlier this year. McIntyre is a Lansing native and Cooley Law School graduate, currently working with the public finance practice groups at Foster Swift Collins and Smith in Lansing. Her appointment requires the approval of the city council. She would become Lansing's first female and first African-American city attorney. Current State Scott Pohl talked with McIntyre after yesterday's press conference. She says the opportunity to make a difference appeals to her.
That's why I went to law school. And this is nothing that I take lightly, because quite often you pursue something in hopes to make a difference, but the opportunity never presents itself. And then me being from Lansing, it has an even special meaning to me.
Can you describe who you work for? Do you report to the mayor? Do you report to the city council? What sorts of duties are there in this job?
Well, the city attorney is just that, the attorney to represent the city of Lansing in this case. So the city of Lansing and its residents, those are my clients. In reporting, I would report to the mayor. I would also report to city council, as we all have a responsibility to respond to the city of Lansing's residents.
Tell me about your background and what prepared you for a job like this.
You know, I really believe that everything that I've done, even prior to law school, has prepared me for a time such as this. I worked for the Department of Human Services as an Equal Employment Officer, and that was really my true introduction into law. Going to law school, I obtained my degree from Cooley, and that definitely prepared me. But also working at Lewis and Mundy and Foster Swift, it helped to craft and perfect, you know, what is needed for this position. But being the city attorney goes so far beyond providing legal advice. I believe it's that you had to have a passion, sense of caring for that which you represent. Being from Lansing and my time here at Lansing, I've given back. I'm really involved in the community as much as I can by my time, by giving my skill and my treasure. So all those things collectively have prepared me. In my practice as an attorney, I focus on municipal law and public finance, directly involved with a lot that's going on with the city, and I think that will help in terms of the economic development that needs to be really taken advantage of here, and I'm hoping that all those things collectively will help me serve the city in the best way possible.
Do you consider this to be a political position, and have you been active politically?
No, I do not consider it to be a political position. Just as the mayor indicated, it's one of professionalism. I think quite often if you get those two things, you know, confused, it may very well prevent you from being able to do the job that's serving in the best interest of the city.
Have you been politically active?
No, I have not. I think what is necessary in any position when you're serving as an attorney is to understand your role. And don't lose sight of your role. And as long as you do that, and keeping in the forefront what your job is, it's advising and making decisions that are of a high legal quality and are accurate, that are in the best interest of the city.
One final question. You said you've had a chance to talk with Briggs Smith about his experience. Did he encourage you to take the job, give you advice about the potential pitfalls in a job like this? How would you describe that conversation?
No, my inquiry really didn't lend itself to that. I just basically wanted to know his experience, and not knowing at that point exactly what he was going on to. I know he would be representing a community. Didn't really know why, you know, so... when he responded as he did, that he loved this job, and knowing that he was going on to do the very same job for a different city, I think that was very telling.
With Lansing's new city attorney designate, Janine McIntyre, thank you very much.
Thank you. I really appreciate this opportunity. I look forward to serving the city of Lansing.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And interestingly enough, we've just learned that the new city attorney, or the appointee anyway, Janine McIntyre, was a student of Ron Brett's at Cooley Law School, who was our previous guest. So the stars aligned on that one this morning. Tomorrow on Current State, we will feature East Lansing's Teen After School Center in our Neighbors in Action segment. Join us for that and more. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore, and you've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by Fluke Hearing, featuring American-made products that provide hearing technology for every lifestyle and life stage, with 8 locations throughout mid-Michigan. FlukeHearing.com. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.